Picture this. It's a warm July evening on Long Island. 1996, the sun is sitting low over the Atlantic, painting the haze orange. From the beaches at East Moriches, families are out, people on boat decks, fishermen watching the water, and offshore, a Boeing 747 is climbing through 13,000 feet, bound for Paris. Then something happens that nobody in the history of commercial aviation had seen before. The center of the aircraft lights up from inside, and a 230-person airliner comes apart over the ocean in seconds. I'm Tower on ATIS, here on Radio Hangar, and today we're going deep on the accident that launched the largest investigation in National Transportation Safety Board history and fundamentally changed how the entire aviation industry thinks about fuel tank flammability. Today's aviation news is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins built to mark the milestones, the discipline, and the pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. AviationSoul.com now. TWA Flight 800, July 17, 1996. About 18,000 hours of airframe time on a Boeing 747-100, tail number November Niner 3119. The airplane had first flown in 1971, 25 years old, well-maintained, operated by an experienced professional crew. The flight had been delayed on the ramp at Kennedy International Airport for about an hour and 15 minutes due to a routine passenger identification check. Nothing unusual. Air conditioning running the whole time. By the time they pushed back, that aircraft had been baking on the ramp on a hot summer afternoon for over an hour. Departure was at 8:02 in the evening. They rolled on runway 22 right, lifted off normally, climbed out over Jamaica Bay, and turned east over the Atlantic. Air traffic control worked them through the altitudes, routing them offshore for the ocean crossing. 12 minutes after takeoff at 8:31 and 50 seconds, New York Center received a routine radio call from the crew, and then the radar return disappeared. Not faded, not degraded, gone. Replaced by a cloud of returns expanding outward from the last known position. 230 people, including 212 passengers and 18 crew members, were gone. What followed was initially a rescue mission. Coast Guard cutters and private vessels converged on the area south of East Moriches. Aircraft overhead. Within hours, it became a recovery mission. There was no one to rescue. Here is where the story gets complicated, and I want to spend some time here because what happened in the first 48 hours set up a public misconception that lasted for years and still circulates today. Witnesses, 270 witnesses, spread across Long Island's South Shore and parts of the Connecticut coastline, reported seeing something they described as a streak of light ascending from the horizon toward the aircraft just before the explosion. Some were very specific. The streak was climbing. It was moving fast. It looked like a flare or a missile. The early news coverage had a narrative before the sun came up the next morning. The Federal Bureau of Investigation opened a parallel criminal investigation alongside the National Transportation Safety Board. They were looking for evidence of a bomb or a surface-to-air missile strike. They would look hard for 14 months. Here is what the physical evidence actually showed. The United States Navy, in what became one of the most remarkable salvage operations in aviation history, recovered 16 million pieces of wreckage from the ocean floor. That is not a rounded number. 16 million identifiable fragments pulled from water averaging around 100 feet in depth spread across roughly 40 square miles of debris field at the surface. The operation took months. Those pieces were transported to a hangar at the former Naval Station Calverton on Long Island, where National Transportation Safety Board investigators, Boeing engineers, and metallurgists spent years reassembling sections of the aircraft. Not the whole aircraft, but enough of it to read the wreckage and to understand where it started. The center wing tank on a Boeing 747. The center wing tank sits in the lower fuselage, between the two main wing fuel tanks, directly above the air conditioning equipment bays. On longer flights, the center wing tank carries fuel. On shorter segments, it is typically depleted first, leaving residual fuel sitting at the bottom of a tank designed to hold tens of thousands of gallons when full on Flight 800. There was roughly 50 gallons of Jet A remaining in the center wing tank. 50 gallons. The rest of that space was vapor. Now here is the physics, and I want every pilot listening to understand this, because it applies to more than Boeing jets. Jet A fuel has a flash point of around 100 degrees Fahrenheit. That means the liquid itself will not sustain combustion below that temperature. But flash point describes the liquid. What matters in an enclosed tank is vapor concentration. In a closed tank with fuel at the bottom, the vapor space above the fuel contains fuel molecules that have evaporated into the surrounding air. If the temperature is high enough, there are enough fuel molecules in that space to make the mixture flammable. There is a range, and it matters. Below the lower explosive limit, there is not enough fuel vapor to ignite. Above the upper explosive limit, there is too much fuel and not enough oxygen. In between is what engineers call the flammable range. On the evening of July 17, 1996, the vapor mixture inside the center wing tank of Flight 800 was in the flammable range when the airplane climbed through 13,000 feet. Here's how it got there. When the aircraft sat on the ramp at Kennedy for over an hour, the air conditioning packs mounted directly beneath the center wing tank were running hard. Those packs generate significant heat. That heat conducted upward into the structure of the aircraft and into the tank above. Fuel temperatures in the center wing tank climbed well above normal during that delay at altitude. The external temperature is cold, but the tank does not cool instantly. The vapor concentration inside the center wing tank was still in the flammable range by the time they reached 13,000 feet, and then something ignited it. The National Transportation Safety Board's four-year investigation was never able to identify the ignition source with absolute certainty. That is a rare and uncomfortable conclusion for an investigation of this scale. The most probable cause identified in the final report released in August of 2000 was a short circuit in the fuel quantity indication system wiring that ran through the center wing tank. A small electrical arc in the wrong place. The mixture went up. The explosion destroyed the forward section of the aircraft. The nose separated. The aircraft, still under thrust from the remaining three engines, climbed briefly before the structural damage caused complete breakup. And that is the answer to the missile question. The Central Intelligence Agency, working with radar data and physics modeling, produced an animated reconstruction of the aircraft's trajectory after the initial explosion. When that animation was presented at a public hearing in 1997, it showed the aircraft's burning fuselage climbing for roughly 40 seconds after the initial explosion, before breaking apart and falling to the ocean. The streak of light that 270 witnesses saw ascending from the horizon was the aircraft itself, not a missile. The geometry fit the eyewitness accounts precisely. They saw exactly what they said they saw. They just couldn't have known what they were actually looking at. The Federal Bureau of Investigation closed its criminal investigation in November of 1997. No bomb, no missile, no criminal act. That left the National Transportation Safety Board to complete what became one of the most technically complex accident investigations in its history. The final report was released in August of 2000, nearly 4 years after the accident. So what changed? In 2001, the Federal Aviation Administration issued Special Federal Aviation Regulation 88. This was significant. It required operators and manufacturers of all Part 25 transport category aircraft to conduct a comprehensive review of their fuel tank systems and identify potential ignition sources. Every airliner in commercial service, not just the 747s, every single one. Operators had to develop new maintenance instructions and limitations specifically designed to eliminate the conditions that could allow ignition of fuel tank vapors. New inspection intervals, new maintenance requirements, wiring redesigns in some cases. It was a massive undertaking across the entire industry. Then, in 2008, the Federal Aviation Administration went further with the Fuel Tank Flammability Reduction Rule. This one applied to new production aircraft and required that every new design incorporate systems specifically to reduce fuel tank flammability during normal operations. The practical result of that rule is the nitrogen inerting system, and it is worth understanding how it works. Instead of leaving the vapor space above the fuel filled with air, which contains the oxygen required for combustion, an inerting system continuously pumps nitrogen-enriched air into the tank headspace. Nitrogen is inert. It will not support combustion. A tank with nitrogen above the fuel cannot develop the conditions that destroyed Flight 800 because there is no free oxygen available for the vapor to react with. These systems pull air from the engine bleed system or from the environment, pass it through a membrane that separates out the oxygen and route the nitrogen-enriched air into the tank. It runs continuously in flight. The result is that the time the fuel-air mixture in the tank spends in the flammable range is dramatically reduced compared to an unprotected design. If you have flown on a Boeing 787, an Airbus A350, or any of the newer production narrow-body jets in the past decade, you have been on an aircraft where fuel tank flammability reduction was a design requirement from day one of the certification program. Baked in from the beginning, required by rules that came directly out of the TWA 800 investigation. The older generation of jets, the 737s and 767s and A320 families built before this rule took effect, went through the Special Federal Aviation Regulation 88 review and had their maintenance programs and wiring systems updated. Some are also being fitted with inerting systems depending on the operator. Now, for those of us flying general aviation aircraft, what's the takeaway? The specific Jet A vapor dynamics don't translate directly to AVGAS flying. The chemistry is different, but the underlying discipline absolutely does. Your fuel system is not a passive storage container. It is an active system, and conditions inside it change with temperature, altitude, and how long you have been sitting on the ramp on a summer afternoon. Know your fuel system, know where your sumps are and why you sump before every flight, know your venting, because unvented tanks can develop pressure differentials that cause their own problems. Know your fuel selector, when you need to switch tanks, and what happens to an engine if you forget. The broader lesson from TWA 800 is about system interactions that weren't fully understood at the time of certification. The Boeing 747 was certified in 1969. The placement of the air conditioning packs beneath the center wing tank was a known design feature. The fuel system had been in service for 27 years before this accident. Nobody was cutting corners on Flight 800. Nobody was knowingly ignoring a risk. The combination of conditions, summer heat, a ramp delay, a nearly empty tank, aging wiring in a complex system, was not fully characterized as a failure mode in any certification document or safety analysis that existed at the time. The accident revealed a gap, and the industry's response to that gap represents exactly how aviation safety has always advanced. Slowly, painfully, definitively. The 230 people on TWA Flight 800 did not choose that role, but their loss and the investigation that followed produced regulations that are protecting every person who boards a commercial airliner today. The National Transportation Safety Board's final report is public record. It runs over 300 pages. If you want to understand how rigorous accident investigation actually works in this industry, it is one of the best documents you will ever read. Sources for today's segment include the National Transportation Safety Board's final report on TWA Flight 800, finalized August of 2000, the Aviation Safety Network, and Aviation Week. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Tower. Know your fuel system.